Simone Conegno is an author and a storyteller. Just an incredibly inspiring story about, where do I start? She climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. She adopted three kids. She just talks about what it's like. She had, challenges as a child of self-doubt, and what she's done with it, and how she inspires. We all have the power to inspire others is one of her themes. And I ask about climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. She's not an athlete, has never done anything like that. She was asked to do it, what the process was, very fascinating. Also the whole process of adoption. And you're not going to believe the democratic system she came up with her other children when it came time to adopt the three others. Very moving, very inspiring. I lost it a little bit on this one, on this discussion. I teared up. Once it comes to children, I'm very soft spot, especially daughters, since I have one. But I know you're going to like this. Simone Conegno, I really enjoyed this conversation. I know you will too. Thanks for listening. Hi, I'm Joey Pins. People ask me, how did I lose 130 pounds? The quick answer is always discipline. I started my business, wasn't paying attention to my health, was eating too much, drinking too much sweets. My daughter was born. Next thing I know, I'm pre-diabetic, I have hypertension. I knew something had to change. Discipline. I, like many of you, have faced many challenges in your career, in your family, in your life, in your faith. How did you attack them? How did you approach them? How did you solve them, hopefully? It all had to have some degree of discipline. I'm also asked, how did you found and start a tech business that lasted over 25 years? Discipline. I was committed to it, enjoyed technology, didn't enjoy some aspects of it, but knew it was necessary. Discipline. Our podcast mission, how do we use discipline to better ourselves and society? Join me, please, as I talk to interesting people and discuss how they use discipline in their family, in their passion, in their careers, and how it helped them. Our podcast vision, growth through learning from others. Joey Pins Discipline Conversations. It'll be light and serious. Join us, please. Thank you for consideration. So nice to meet you, Simone Conegno. So, first question. How do we have the power to inspire others? One of your themes.
So each of us brings incredible value to the world. And I think we need to, look at ourselves and say, we all matter. And so by the choices we make every day, we inspire the people around us. And it took me a long time to realize that, right? Like I think we look at ourselves in a way that tends to be a bit too judgmental versus the positive side of saying, hey, what do I bring to the world? Because we bring amazing things to the world, each and every one of us.
Yeah, that is true. And most especially yourself. Your story is absolutely incredible. I don't even know where to start. Let's start with Kilimanjaro. the second highest peak, the highest peak in Africa. Please share.
So that was obviously a very unique experience. I am not an athlete, so it was more of a leap of faith. It was, my husband was asked to do it, and he said, no, thank you. Call Simone. And they did. And I said, yes. And it was a lot. I had to get myself in shape. I mean, number one, so not just physically, but mentally as well. This was a big undertaking to truly believe in myself that I could do something like this. And I think it's really the first time, looking back, that I said, okay, I'm going to do this. And I believed in myself. And that's kind of what happened. So I set the goal. I put in the work behind it. So it wasn't just about, I know a lot of times we get to January 1st and we set all these goals. But it's not about setting the goal. It's about putting in the work to achieve the goal. And it was really important for me to kind of say, hey, I believe in myself. I can do this. And I went with There were 16 of us. I didn't know anybody.
Yeah, strangers.
Yeah. And but an amazing team. And we came together as a team. We came together as friends. And when we made it to the summit, it was really obviously a special moment, not just for making it to the summit, but with this group of people who were so inspiring. Some were cancer survivors, others were climbing in honor of family or friends. And, you know, looking back at that moment, it was that moment of feeling like that mindset is what got me there, putting everything else, you know, beside and saying, you got this, you know, one foot in front of the other, you can do this. And that's, fortunately, that's how it turned out.
I have to, how was the question framed to you? I mean, if I got a call saying, hey, let's, you know, please, like, how did they ask? And what made you say yes? You've never mountain climbed before. You're not an athlete.
No. I've gone camping a few times.
I want to talk about those stories.
Yeah.
Too, by the way.
So my, a friend of ours had climbed it the year before. And so he had climbed it with the Live Strong Foundation, and that kind of mixing philanthropy with a challenge, kind of hard to say no to that one. Mm. And I think it was a moment for me to say that, yeah, I really want to give something a try, that I want to challenge myself. I want to prove to myself that I can do something that is way out of my comfort zone. And it was way out of my comfort zone. But, you know, I'm from Florida, sleeping in the tent at night. It was really cold. Figuring out how to use a sleeping bag. Okay, that's a ridiculous thing, right? But actually, myself and my tent mate, neither of us knew like the whole mummy hood thing where you just have like this exposed. So the first morning, we're like, are you freezing? She's like, I'm freezing. And then we're like, oh, that's how it works. You know, you got to really totally close your... Okay, it sounds ridiculous, but when you haven't done something like that before, you know, you don't know. So, but definitely I would do it again because it was such a powerful experience for me. Obviously there's lots of mountains out there, but, you know, it's something I would do again because even though it was extremely challenging, both mentally and physically, it was extremely powerful and it really put me on the path to where I am today.
From the point that you were asked to the started climbing was how long?
About 6 months.
And then what were you given, how did you train?
Yeah. So I did some research. The organization, they had a person that I could talk to and say, okay, like I am going, and I wasn't in horrible shape. Right now I'm in horrible shape. my COVID shape, right? But I was going to a boxing gym already. And so I definitely was working out, but not like I needed to be. I mean, I was getting, after I committed, I was getting on the treadmill at the maximum incline every day. I was wearing this elevation training mask. I don't know if you've ever seen one of those, but it's basically a mask that has these valves on the side that you can adjust and replace to kind of mimic the elevation that you're at. So I think it went up to like 15,000 feet or something. Now, obviously, it has nothing to do with oxygen. This mask has to do with lung capacity. So you have to breathe very hard to get the air in through these. As you change out the valves, the little holes get smaller and smaller. And so I would wear that when I would be on the treadmill or when I was boxing. And I think it really helped, actually. It was, again, oxygen is a different story, but building my lung capacity, I could hold my breath for a long time after I did that for 6 months.
Very interesting. And are you breathing primarily through the nose or through the mouth?
In this contraption, it's kind of however you can do it. I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm more of a mouth breather, which I've heard isn't the best thing because I guess you want to breathe through your nose because all of the little hairs in your nose, all these kinds of weird things. But I'm a mouth breather. So...
You get to Mount Kilimanjaro. How long does it take? You meet these strangers, but they're on the same quest as you. How long to summit?
Yeah, we were 5 days up, 2 days down. So we definitely took a bit of a longer route so that we could acclimate, which I think is key, because if you look at the statistics, there's a lot of people who don't make it to the summit. Even though Kilimanjaro is not a technically challenging mountain, you know, when you're at 19,000 feet, it's very hard to breathe. So really taking the time to get used to, even when you're at 15,000 feet, being able to get used to that elevation before you make the summit attempt.
And part of you doing this, you say, was philanthropical, but it was also to, like we first talked about, to help inspire others. You could do things out of your box, out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, I mean, I always say to people, if I can do it, and it's not inspiring people specifically to climb Kilimanjaro, right? I mean, you got to find your Kilimanjaro. I think, again, there's so many times where we don't believe in ourselves, and really looking at a challenge that you want. It's not saying you, like, if you would have asked me 10 years ago, I would have said, oh, I could never do that. And, but that's not the question. The question is, do you want to do that? Right. So by using our words in the wrong way. So there's, we don't use the word can't, because can't means won't, you won't even try. So if you want to do something, what do you want to do? What is your Kilimanjaro? What is something that you really want to challenge yourself with? Whether it's a 5K or it's applying for a different job, whatever it is, like, what's your Kilimanjaro? And that's the inspiration, is to kind of look at yourself. And it doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, what you do. It's about what you're capable of, because you are capable of things, many things.
You certainly are. And you've, you know, you're the extraordinary, unordinary you. You certainly symbolize that. And you've had many, you talk about challenges in your youth where you were kind of told you couldn't do certain things and you were kind of boxed in a bit.
Yeah. You know, I had very supportive parents, but they definitely saw things a certain way. You know, I was going to go into medicine, and again, no regrets. Everything in, I believe that, you know, in my path has led me to where I am today. But both my parents were doctors, and I didn't realize the significance of that until I got older. My mom going to medical school in 1961, she was one of five women in her medical school class. She, you know, she grew up in rural Pennsylvania on a farm where her mom had a sixth grade education. Her dad worked in the coal mines and a local brewery, and she realized in 10th grade that she wanted to continue her education. And that moment was when she walked into a library for the first time in 10th grade and realized that the world is a very big place. And so my mom is a huge inspiration for me, but they also, you know, they were kind of like, you should do medicine, or you know. And so I failed organic chemistry. And then I got a D in it the second time around. And then I said, you know what? I don't think medicine is the right thing for me, because I don't think they're going to take me. And so then my parents were like, well, you know what? You're good at math. Go into accounting. And I did. I got a master's in accounting. I have my CPA.
Gator.
Yep. I'm a gator. But I didn't love it, right? I didn't love it. And I wanted to figure out. It took me a long time to figure out. I changed my mind many times to figure out what I was passionate about. And it's about telling stories. It's storytelling. It's speaking. It's human connection. It's, I wouldn't say, you know, writing my book was another leap, because, again, I wasn't a writer, but I'm a storyteller. So what I wanted to come across in the book was that I'm sharing my stories like a conversation on the couch, not like big words that I wouldn't use in real life. And that's hopefully how it came across. But going back to the when I was younger phase, you know, one of the things that I really, looking back, what I wish I could have done differently is that a lot of my value was from what other people said. And I had a boyfriend when I was 16 who told me that I was fat, and that he couldn't believe how many stretch marks I had, and that I should probably have a salad at dinner, and those kinds of things. And I think it really was the beginning of my path with self-doubt, as I look back at that today, because I was skinny. I was, like, you know, tiny compared to what I am now. And, you know, I But it was such a thing. And I see it today, too. I mean, things haven't changed in our world, and that a lot of girls get their value from what other people say, what they see on social media, all of these different things. And, you know, so for me, that kind of shaped my path. Fortunately, it took me a long time. Unfortunately, it took me a long time. But fortunately, I figured out, okay, wait, I don't need to. My value is not based on anything but how I feel about myself, how I reach out in the world, and that's what's important to me.
Well put. I have daughters, you know, and I see that sometimes. I could just kind of see it spill out a little bit of what others think about them, what value they place on it. And I do my best to try to enlighten and, you know, give some perspective, but as much as a father can, you know, daughters are going to listen as much as they want, but it is true. It is shaped that way. And I guess that's a perfect segue into your children and the democratic way that you introduced your adopted children is so inspiring and so cool. Please share.
Thanks. Raising kids, it takes a village. It takes a village. And when you already have three and you want to add more, I think it takes everybody in the family to be in the right mindset about it. I've had people say to me, if you were to give birth to another child, would you ask your children for permission? It's a really interesting question because I never thought about it like that, right?
That is.
Luckily, I don't have to make that decision because I'm not having any. So, right. But when we talked about adoption, it was very important for us, for the whole family, to be on board. So we would take a vote each time. It had to be unanimous, and they would write their answer down on a piece of paper. Now, obviously, when they were little, it was just like, "Oh, cool, another sibling." But as they got older, it was, you know, obviously they understood that there's more to it, that everybody has to contribute. Everybody has to help out. It's not just me raising a child. It's the whole family. We're a family and we all help out. And so we had when we went to have our sixth child, we were sitting at the table and we did the vote and the kids passed over their paper and instantly my daughter Olivia passed hers over, and I said to her, I said, "You didn't hesitate." And of course, everybody voted yes. And I said, "You didn't hesitate." And she said, "Mom, we're talking about the life of another child. How could anyone vote no?" And so that's the, you know, again, the perspective from a child, which I think is, you know, really a powerful thing that we could all look at and say how we see the world and how we see each other. If we could all look at it that way, then we might be a little bit different.
Yeah, that was incredible when I learned about that. And how old was your daughter at that point?
Okay, let me think. So that was 11 years ago. So she was around six and a half, seven. So she's 18 now. So
that's absolutely incredible. And and how has the introduction been to the adopted children, and what was that like?
Yeah,
they all wanted it. They all said yes, and now here we are.
You know what? They were always, all of them were always great about it. I mean, trust me, there are moments when there's somebody screaming, but it doesn't matter who's screaming. I mean, you know, their kids are kids, right? Like there was really never that. There was never an issue where they said, "Oh, that's my Asian brother," or "That's my Black brother. That's my brother." I mean, I think sometimes we get so caught up in labels and how we describe people. Like my mom, people will say, "Oh, she was a female physician." No, she was a physician. Mm. You know, so it's brother and sister. There's not like and sure, like there's a lot of things that we do discuss, but you know, we're a regular everyday family that's just a little bit more colorful.
And the decision to introduce or to adopt, what was that like? Was it an idea? Was it trying to inspire others? Was it saying, what happened there?
No, it was just a way that we were building our family. I mean, we had talked about it in between our first two kids because it took a longer time to get pregnant in between Jacob and Emma. But it was, there's no conversation of rescuing children or anything like that. This is how we built our family. I mean, it's really nothing more than that. I mean, our kids really, when you think about it, they started at a place of loss. So when we're talking about, you know, people use the term the savior complex. There's no savior complex. We are, we're their parents. And they did lose everything before we met them. And it's not even about rebuilding because you can't replace anything that they lost. It's about building. And we're very fortunate. They're amazing kids. We have an amazing family. And we're very thankful that they have really, you know, brought this understanding of the world to our eyes, right? Like we see the world differently because of the family that we have.
And the process to adopt them, was it difficult?
Yeah, it was difficult, but I would say that it, you know, and I don't even know what it's like now, but I think it's even more difficult now. It changed drastically between each adoption. So Millie, we probably waited close to, was 18 months that before we were chosen to be her family. Wow. But with Ari, it was quick. With Noah, it was quick. It was, you know, 9 months from the time we put in our paperwork till the time we got to meet them. But Millie definitely had changed a lot. A lot of the rules had changed and now it's completely different. So
do you meet them at point of introduction or how do you know that Millie was the one? I don't know anything about this process.
Yeah. So when we adopted, it's actually a really interesting question because for all three of our children, we did not meet them ahead of time. So for Noah, he's our son Nuts from South Korea. So we actually had to refinalize the adoption in the United States. But for Millie and for Ari, it was actually final when we brought them home. So, and what was interesting was that, you know, I think sometimes people go into the idea of adoption as it is, you know, rainbows and unicorns. And, you know, you have to realize, again, going back to the point that our kids started a place of loss. So sometimes people will think that they're going in and they're rescuing this child. Doesn't work that way. And it's very hard sometimes for it to work out. Because when people go in there with the, I don't want to say wrong intentions, but the wrong assumptions of what it's going to be like, you know, it's hard work. I mean, Ari was 4.5 years old. He remembers, right? He knows what his life was like. He has, like, you know, he had trauma, right? You know, I mean, you lose your family at 4.5 years old. And so, you know, so the process changed. The reason I'm telling you the story is because the process changed. So I know after we adopted Millie, they changed the process in Ethiopia so that you would actually go do a meeting with the child and go to the embassy then. And then you would have like another 6 weeks, you'd come home and then you'd go back again to bring your child home so that people didn't have, because I think there was a period of time where, people didn't know what to do. The adoption was final and they maybe didn't realize what they were signing up for. And then at that point, what do you do? I mean, you've seen horrible stories in the news about things that have happened, right? Where people try to put their child on a plane back to a different country because they can't handle it. And so there definitely are many more steps in place and precautions because the children need to be protected.
And are you working completely with that country's government or agency, or is an American agency involved as well?
Yeah, we worked with an American agency. So they have their program set up in such a way that they have, you know, people on the ground that work with the government there, and so that it's a very legitimate process and not anything that we would have to look back later and say, oh my gosh, I can't believe we did this. So we were very fortunate to work with a really great agency that really had the kids' best interest in mind.
Is there lots of improvement in that process? Is there room for it?
Well, to be honest, I haven't looked in a while. I mean, there's always, you know, room for improvement in every process, right? But I think there are a lot of countries right now that are shut down for international adoption. And again, that's like research I haven't done in recent days to see the exact reasons of why things are the way they are. But again, it's complicated when you're talking about children. Like, you really, like, the best interest of the children, obviously first best interest would be for them to be able to stay with their birth family. Okay. That's not always the case, because I'll have people say that to me. Well, what do you think? I didn't make that decision. You know, my decision was to adopt these children. And so really, when you talk about best interest, it's making sure that they're coming to a safe and secure place, and really have, it's all about love. It's not about anything else. It's not about show. It's about the love we have for our kids.
Certainly. So you'd say you're a storyteller. Two stories that I really liked. I'll say Snake Bite and Wash Cycle.
Yes. Yeah. So Noah was bitten by a poisonous snake at summer camp. And it's a phone call, like, first of all, you never expect to get, right? Like, you hear these random stories, but it's never going to happen to us. And I was actually out of the country, and I get a phone call from my husband that, you know, this panicked call saying, you know, and I'm like, come on, man, like, you're a physician, like, let's be like specific in your words, like, you're freaking me out. But, you know, it was a panic situation. So he calls me and he's like, Noah was bitten by a poisonous snake at camp. I'm finished my surgery. I'm literally heading to the airport to get on the plane. I can't tell you anything more right now. If you want to know any more information, just call the camp. I got to go. Wow. And I was like, okay, that's a really crappy phone call. What do I do with this? I'm literally in a different country. And so I did. I called the camp and I said, my husband just called me and they said, let me put you through to the doctor. And they basically said that, you know, at first they said, well, we don't think it was poisonous, but we're just taking every precaution. So we're sending him in an ambulance down the mountain, which takes about 2 hours to get to the hospital. And then they said, let's set up a WhatsApp group. And it wasn't like 5 minutes later, I get a message in the WhatsApp group that said, change of plans. We're going to take him to the nearest community airport and we're going to have a helicopter meet us there. And of course, at this point, I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, I had like 5 minutes of like breathing because I'm like, oh, okay, maybe it's okay. And I called and I said, like, I need to know more and I need to understand, is there someone from the camp with him? And they said, yeah, the nurse from the camp is with him. And I said, can I call her? And they said, yes, you can call her. So I called her and I said, can you please talk to me as a parent, not as an employee of the camp, like, just, I need to know exactly what's happening. And she said, okay, as a parent, I am scared to death right now. She's like, in this short period of time, his arm got gigantic and he, you know, and so that's why we got the, you know, we're worried about compartment syndrome, where if it gets so swollen that it cuts off the blood flow. And so that's why we have the helicopter. And, you know, it was scary when she said it, but I appreciated it because I wanted to know what was happening. It's not like I could get there in an hour or 2 hours. It would take me 27 hours to get there from where I was. And to be able to have someone tell me, you know, completely what was happening and then call me back and say, okay, we're here. And you know, it was important as a parent to understand like the details of it. And he did great. So my husband met him at the hospital. He had multiple vials of anti-venom and his arm was a big balloon for days. And And if you ask him about it, he's like, the helicopter ride was really cool, Mom. I'm like, of course it was. Of course it was. And he's such a sweet kid that they said that they found the snake and they killed it, whether it was really or not, I don't know. But and he's like, oh, Mom, why would they do that? You know, it's not the snake's fault. Like, it's living in the wild. I was out there. My ball went where it was, and I went to grab the ball, and that's when it bit me. And I thought that was really sweet. But I was like, you know, the hard part, though, is that there's a lot of people. There's a lot of kids around there. So if it happened again, it could be, you know, we were very fortunate. I mean, he got bit twice, actually. And so, you know, we were really fortunate that he did okay. So, and he's not scared of snakes, which is the crazy part. He's like, you know, she was just protecting. Okay.
And there's professional people at the camp, and they did the right thing, and they all acted accordingly.
Yeah. And so he did great because everybody did understand, like, okay, whether it's poisonous or not, let's take every precaution. And, you know, and then he ended up going. So he got discharged from the hospital after a couple days, and there was still one night left at camp. So he asked my husband if they could go back up to the camp for that one last night. That was definitely like his 15 minutes of fame, right? Like, everybody was like, oh my gosh, it's Noah. And he did. It was a great experience for him to go back and, like, and maybe that's why he's not afraid, because he went back in that moment and saw that everything, you know, everything was still going on. So, yeah, it was really one of those experiences, right? A few extra gray hairs from that one.
Yeah, great, great story. And the other with the wash cycle, I guess.
Yeah, the wash cycle is a great one. So we were in Italy for my best friend from college for her wedding. And it was when we had three kids. And so we brought all three kids with us. And our youngest daughter actually had rotavirus right before we left. So she was in the hospital for three nights and got discharged from the hospital literally the day we were leaving. And so we got on a flight that night and went to Italy. And there's lots of stories about Italy, let me tell you. But so there was one day where my friend was having a reception at one of the vineyards. And so, of course, we can't bring the kids there. So my husband, you know, very generously said, Simone, why don't you go? And I said, oh, absolutely. I'll go. I like wine. Sure. You can take the kids. I'll go. And so he decided – so I went on my merry way, and he decided to take the kids with my friend's dad into the village, into San Gimignano. And so after – the driving there, which is a whole nother story. Olivia, who was the youngest at the time, she desperately had to go to the bathroom. And so they parked the car, and it's a bathroom that you have to put a coin in. Fortunately, they had a coin. That was, you know, but so they, sure. They were, the door was locked. So they were waiting, and the door opens. The woman comes out that was in the bathroom, and Olivia runs in, the door closes because I'm sure, you know, Rob was talking, who knows what was happening. The door closes, and all of a sudden you hear her screaming and you hear the spray cycle go on. So this is an automatic self-cleaning bathroom. So the reason, you know, obviously she's supposed to wait until the door closes, it cleans itself, and then she puts the coin in and she goes back in, but it didn't happen that way. So the poor girl, she was, you know, the wash cycle totally cleaned her. She was soaked from head to toe and completely traumatized. And, you know, there's so many funny parts to that story. She actually used it as a college essay of things that she's gone through in her life, you know, that have shaped who she is. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, crap happens every day, right? Like, there's things that happen, and we're just like, you know, you got to kind of laugh about it. And for me, one of the best parts of that story was that, okay, they get her cleaned up and they walk around the village and they come home and they walk into and she was complaining the whole day that her feet hurt. And my husband's like, well, yeah, you got wet, so your feet hurt. Sure. And they get back into the house after, you know, the whole day out, and my friend's dad looks at Olivia and says, Rob, You put her shoes on the wrong feet. Right. That's why she was complaining all day. Poor girl. So like traumatic, yes, absolutely, yeah. In multiple ways.
Fascinating. Do you remember any of the Italian? Tu parli italiano?
I don't. I mean, I you know, it's funny. When I was a little kid, I remember being at where I live now. My parents had a condo here that we would come down to from Buffalo, New York, and I met a little girl who was Italian. So she taught me how to count to 10. So that's about all I remember still in Italian. So yeah.
My father's Italian immigrant. I'm in New Haven, from New Haven, and at 10 years old, he put me on a plane and I went by myself to Italy and visited my relatives. I was there every other summer. So, you know, those kinds of stories that that you talk about, where Americans don't really understand how things work over there. It's relatively harmless, but life learning experience. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, at least for good humor and good stories, right?
Absolutely. Your book, The Extraordinary Unordinary You. Tell me, why did you write it? I mean, obviously you got stories, but you said you were never a writer. Just talk to me about your process and why you did it.
So I was doing public speaking through a volunteer organization, and that kind of sparked it for me because I didn't really realize at the time the impact of a story. I mean, sure, if we think back, yeah, okay, that impacted me. But really sharing my own stories, again, when you look at yourself and say, I don't think I really make a difference, and then you're getting up on stage and you're telling stories and people are telling you, wow, your stories are really inspiring. Thank you for sharing that. And it's kind of, you got to put two and two together and say, okay, wait, all of us have a story. We all can make a difference by sharing our stories. And so I kind of took that forward into writing a book, because a lot of people would ask me, have you written a book? No, I'm not a writer. Again, limiting myself. And so I said, why not? Why not write a book? I mean, I love telling stories. I can write it like I'm telling it to someone so that it comes out in my voice. And I think I accomplished that. My husband said so. My friends said they could hear my voice inside their head. And I said, thank you. Sorry, but thank you. But, you know, the process was, I mean, I did it over a year, which I think is pretty reasonable, but a lot of it was over COVID time, right? So we had all the kids at home again. So even our oldest, he was out in California doing his master's, and they were shutting everything down. And so he was living on campus at the time, so he had nowhere to go. He's like, I guess I'm coming home. And I said, I guess you are. I thought I told you at 3 years old, once you're out, but I guess you're coming home. And honestly, it was when you look at silver linings, to be able to have all of the kids home together in the stage they were, right? Like, so, you know, when Jacob left, he's 25 now. So he was 18 when he went off to school. And of course he was home like here and there for, you know, to visit us, but really having the kids reconnect as teenagers instead of teenagers and young adults, instead of him remembering them when they were really little. So that was a really great experience. And so some of my best writing actually came when all the crazies were in the room, because it would bring back all those memories of the stories and the details of the stories that I hadn't thought about in a long time. So sometimes I needed quiet, and sometimes the louder the better, because I was like, oh my gosh, that reminds me of that story.
And did you storyboard? Did you write pen to paper? What's your process?
Yeah, I started with an outline, and then I kind of figured out within the outline what stories, and I did storyboard because it's something I do for speaking, what kind of putting all the stories out there. And then again, as I'm reminded of other stories, then I would, you know, say, oh, wait, I think I'd rather have that story in here. Or even there are stories that happened while I was writing that I ended up putting in the book. So that was really important. And then going back and really, word choice was really important to me. And trust me, there's still mistakes. I mean, one of the funniest things was that a friend of mine, I sent her a copy of the book, and She's reading it and she sends me a picture. She's like, did you mean to say this? And I was like, are you kidding me? So like, you know, you have it,
right,
everything professionally checked, you know, edited, and, you know, and there's still mistakes, and that's how it works, right? We're human. But her mistake was hilarious. The mistake she found was hilarious, because what I wrote was that I turn lemonade into lemons. I was like, didn't you know that was my superpower? Instead of turning lemons into lemonade, I can turn it backwards. I can turn lemonade into lemons. And you know how many people read it without ever seeing that?
Right.
Right. Because your brain sees what it thinks it should see. Right. And so, and I was like, congratulations, you won the prize for finding the funniest mistake, because like, how ridiculous is that? But I said, you know, like, we're human, right? We make mistakes, and to criticize someone because of a mistake. So I just said, yeah, that's my superpower. Just tell your friends about it.
Very neat.
I mean, you know, so like the process was, it probably wasn't a typical process, because I would probably do it differently now that I've had more experience. Mm. And, you know, but I can't tell you exactly what I would do differently, but I would probably start the whole process differently. I would probably rate also to, you know, I self-published this one, and maybe I would try to look for a publisher on the next one. And there will be a next one, because I constantly am swirling stories around. But yeah, it was a really unique experience. And especially, I think it was another thing that taught me, like, don't limit ourselves. Like, if we really want to do something, again, it goes back to, do you want to do this? Not, is someone else telling you have to, you know, make that choice to really push through it and do it.
Is the publishing industry fair?
Ooh, that's a great question, and I don't know if I have enough knowledge to answer that. I would say it's really tough. So if you don't get in with a big publisher,
there's only, you know, four, right?
It's hard to get known, right? It's hard for people to hear about you. So one of the things I didn't know about is that writing the book is one thing, marketing the book.
Mm.
That's a whole nother story. That is like, you know, everything is hard. Like, everybody's like, oh, social media. Well, you know, there's algorithms for everything. So if you don't fit in that algorithm for that day, like, maybe two people see your post. So really looking at those things, I definitely would, I understand a lot more about it now. I don't know what I would do differently though with that, because it's really being, like a lot of things in life, being at the right place at the right time, finding the right person to read it and share it with their friends, and one of their friends saying, wow, I want to share this with the world. So that's a lot to ask, right? I mean, there's millions of books out there. So it is tough. But I think that the nice thing now that you can self-publish is that everybody does have a chance. It's just, you know, when I look at some of the people, comparing it to a different industry. So looking at musicians, and, you know, there used to be a very specific path, right, in terms of how do you get discovered. And now you can put your music out there for the world to hear on your own. And that's led to a lot of people having contracts that probably never would have in the traditional industry. So I look at it the same way in writing, is that, you know, it opens a lot more doors. You know, the bigger doors are very hard to get in, but it opens a lot more doors for a lot more people to be able to put their work out there.
Yeah. And, you know, there's just less bookstores. You know, the big Strand there in New York City is an exception, of course, but there's just less bookstores. And do you mind if people listen to books versus read them?
No, not at all. And actually, you know, one of my plans was to do an audiobook. I feel like if I do an audiobook, I should record it, since it's my story. Because I've had people reach out and say, oh, would you like me to record your book for you? But again, everything costs money. But it is important to me, because of having a child who has dyslexia and doesn't love to read but loves to listen to books, that, you know, I think it's important for me to add that to what I'm doing.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, it's similar to even podcasting, you know, and, you know, we can get things out there. Musicians can get music out there. People who love to talk and tell stories, we can get it out there, but will many people listen? You know, that's the real tough question. So what else could you tell us about your book? I mean, you're an extraordinary person. The title itself, The Unordinary You, what else could you tell us about it to inspire us?
For me, it was, you know, it's the realization of what we're capable of. So it really isn't just about me. It's my stories, but hopefully with the inspiration for other people to realize what the impact that their stories could make. And that it's important to share the ridiculous stories, the hard stories, as well as the great stories. Like, I think it's really, storytelling isn't just about sharing our shiny moments. It's about sharing our tough moments. You know, I talk about when my daughter was diagnosed with Crohn's, and you know, that was a really hard moment because we weren't expecting that. And she definitely is a kid who, she makes lemonade out of lemons. You know, I'll say it the right way. She could have just sat there and been miserable and felt sorry for herself. And there are days where she's like, I'm miserable, you know, because she's in pain or she, you know, she can't eat something that she wants to eat. But in general, she has a really positive outlook because she has a choice, right? We have a choice of when we have obstacles in front of us, how we react to them. And so I thought it was important to write about her. And I think it's important to talk about her. All my kids have their great stories to tell, but because we do have a choice every day in how we react to things. We might not be able to control what's happening to us, but we can control how we react to it. And so she definitely is an inspiration watching her and how she moves forward. You know, she's only 18 years old and, you know, this is a lifelong thing. And she met it. She's so funny. So when we were up in New York, we met with a new physician that's taking over her care up there. And I actually wasn't able to go because only one parent or guardian because of COVID. And so my husband went, which makes more sense since he's a physician. And so he calls me afterwards. He's like, okay, your daughter's hilarious. So the doctor walks in the room and instead of my daughter saying, hi, it's so nice to meet you, my daughter's like, oh my God, I love your pants. And the doctor's like, oh, thank you so much. she was like, they built a connection off of the pants from like second number one. So forget that they were in a doctor's office talking about her Crohn's. No, they were, you know, Olivia was all about the fashion. So, you know, there's always like that light moment that she has a great way of, you know, talking to people and making, you know, it's fun to watch.
Certainly is. I have an Olivia as well. And it's just, you've inspired me. You continue to inspire me, Simone Canedo. And I know you have others. Thank you so much for your time today. I really enjoyed the conversation. I wish you continued success. I can't wait for your second book. And thanks again for your time and you be well. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me here today.
Thank you for listening and or viewing Joey Pinn's Discipline Conversations. Please share this episode with one or two of your friends who you think may benefit from the episode. Our website, www.joeypins.com. There you find lots of resources and you could join our mailing list. Please follow us on all our social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Podcast information, the video version of our podcast is on YouTube. Please subscribe. Audio is on all major podcasting platforms. Please follow them. And if you like it, please consider giving 5-star rating. Would really appreciate that. Would you like to financially support the podcast? You can go to our Patreon site. Consider $5, $10, or $20 a month. There's all kind of plans that we have there. It's like a one-time payment. What is this podcast episode worth to you? $25, $50, $100, $500, $1,000, $5,000. You be the judge. You can go to our PayPal account to do that as well. Thank you again for listening or watching Joey Pinn's Discipline Conversation.